What the Senate health care bill might mean for your family. U.S. Senate Republican leadership last week unveiled a working version of its proposed health care bill. The Congressional Budget Office is expected to issue its score of the bill, its analysis of the cost and impact, as early as today. Meantime, several Republican senators have expressed reservations about the bill, including Susan Collins. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has called the bill a discussion draft and says there will be changes in the next couple days to address those concerns. But what's in the plan? What would it mean for different types of people and for states? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about it with Julie Rovner, who's a former NPR correspondent, now with Kaiser Health News, and with Lori Parham of AARP. The GOP tackles health care. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell hopes to hold a vote later this week on legislation to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The Senate bill was released late last week, and today many are anticipating the Congressional Budget Office score of the bill. Today we're going to talk about what's in the Senate bill, and what might be next for Obamacare. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Julie Rovner. She is the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow and Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She spent 16 years as health policy correspondent for NPR. And in the studio with me is Lori Parham. She is the Maine State Director for AARP. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the Senate or the House health care bills or about Obamacare? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Julie Rovner, thanks so much for joining us. And why don't we just start? Where do things stand right now with the health care bill in the Senate? Is it going to even pass?
Well, right now, at first, we weren't even sure it was going to come to the floor this week, although it seems likely that it will. We are awaiting a score from the Congressional Budget Office to say how much this would cost, whether it meets all the requirements of the instructions that were given to the Senate in the budget resolution, and how many people it would leave insured or uninsured. Then it'll have to go through a process where the Senate parliamentarian decides what pieces can be included in the bill, and then it could go to the floor where it would be subject first to a vote. Before it even gets to the floor, there would be a vote, and some people are trying to defeat that vote. But if it gets past that initial preliminary vote, there would be 20 hours of debate, and then as many amendments as members can stay awake to offer.
So what we're hearing about right now is not actually a bill that's being brought to the floor. It's a draft discussion.
That's right. The bill that's actually going to be brought to the floor is the bill that passed the House. It's just the way they're doing it. It enabled the Senate to bypass the Senate committees. Normally, the Senate committees would have, you know, written their own bill and brought it to the Senate floor, and then the Senate and the House would have gone to a conference. But that would have taken longer than Republicans want to spend on this. So the Republicans procedurally are going to bring up the Senate bill and at some point in that debate offer their own substitute bill. And that's what the senators will eventually vote on.
Okay, so if it were to pass the Senate, but it were different than the House bill, what happens after that?
Well, normally, as I said, they would go to conference and they could spend days or weeks or even months ironing out their differences. But what Republicans want to have happen is that the Senate bill, as it's passed, goes back to the House and then the House just takes it. So if as soon as the House and Senate pass the same bill, it can go to the president for his signature.
Okay, Lori, what are you hearing from the 230,000 AARP members in Maine? What do they think of the bill, what they know about it?
Well, there's a lot of concern over this proposal. Our members are 50 plus, and this bill would impact those 50 to 64 who are purchasing insurance through the individual market, but also would impact Medicare and Medicaid. And so we're hearing from individuals, some who weren't crazy about the ACA, but think this is worse, and some who've had real success buying coverage through the individual marketplace of the Affordable Care Act, who are very concerned about how their costs will go up, and especially for that 50 to 64 age group, when they see the changes in age rating, what we call an age tax, that would allow insurance companies to charge older Americans five times as much or more in premiums that they would younger adults, that's a real concern. Real concerns over pre-existing conditions. And then, of course, Medicaid is the primary payer for long-term care. Hearing from a lot of folks who wonder what that will mean at a time when they may need Medicaid later on.
Julie, I know it's a complicated piece of legislation, but I want to talk about the basic changes it would be bring about. Would the health care exchanges go away? Would the GOP be replacing them with tax credits to help people pay premiums? Is that sort of the basic outline of how this is going to work?
Well, I don't think it anticipates that the exchanges would go away. But what it does is it restructures how people, which people and how much they would get in help to pay their premiums. And it would also, I mean, more importantly, as we've just heard, it would profoundly change the Medicaid program beyond what the Affordable Care Act did. The Affordable Care Act expanded the Medicaid program to people who were not, you know, who didn't fit into another category. They weren't children or seniors or disabled or pregnant women. It just basically said if you had a low income, you could get Medicaid. It would roll that back, but it would also permanently cap the Medicaid program. It would no longer be an open-ended entitlement as it has been since it was created in 1965. So that would be a huge, dramatic change, probably the biggest change in this bill, even beyond what it would do for people who buy their own insurance in the individual market.
When you say it no longer be an open-ended entitlement, what do you mean? That people would only be able to have Medicaid for a certain amount of time or only for a certain until their coverage met a certain cost?
Well, basically what it says is that right now people who are eligible are entitled to Medicaid, and the state pays a share and the federal government pays a share. And what this would do is it would cap the amount, the share that the federal government pays, and basically leave it to the states to decide how they want to make up that difference, whether they want to make, you know, have fewer people eligible or have the same people eligible for fewer benefits, or whether they want to pay providers less or whether they want to raise taxes. I mean, those are pretty much the only options. The National Association of State Medicaid Directors came out today with a very strong statement that said that there's no amount of flexibility that can make up for the amount of cuts that are anticipated in this legislation.
Now, Laura, you mentioned also Medicare, and I know that the many AARP members depend on Medicare. How does this bill affect Medicare coverage for Americans over 65?
So the bill repeals taxes on industry, pharma, technology companies, the tanning bed industry. And those were taxes that went in to fund the solvency of the program, to fund the program. And so what cutting these taxes would do on industry is decrease the solvency of the program and how long Medicare could pay full benefits. And the other concern that we have as well is that if you are making it more difficult for people to get coverage between the ages of 50 and 64, this is a group that over time, as you get older, you have multiple chronic conditions. If these folks go without coverage, they're going to be more expensive for Medicare over the long haul as well.
So if folks between the ages of 50 and 64 are avoiding getting a mammogram or not treating their diabetes or something like that, then when they do come to Medicare, they'll be more expensive.
That's right.
Okay. Well, we're going to go now to Gordon Smith. Gordon is the executive president of the Maine Medical Association. Hi, Gordon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good. What is the Maine Medical Association's view of the Senate bill? And let's back up and say the Maine Medical Association represents doctors in Maine, correct?
About 4,000 doctors and medical students and residents in training. That's right. And anticipating your question, we're not enthused about this bill. We weren't enthused about the House bill. As I said in a recent statement, the bill is very bad for if you're sick, if you're old, if you live in a rural area, or if you're poor. This is a very bad deal. And in large swaths of Maine, I'm sitting in Washington County right now in Millbridge. There are a lot of all those categories. And so we can't support a bill that, you know, takes people away from their coverage when we think that the most important thing is to get everybody coverage. So, no, we're very disappointed with it, and we'll be doing all that we can to to defeat it.
What will be the impact of the proposal on patients needing treatment for opioid or heroin addiction?
Well, that's complicated, but, you know, because so many people who suffer from substance use disorders either have no income at all or very low income, most of them don't have commercial insurance. So they are either insured or they're on Medicaid. And so anything that hurts Medicaid and doesn't give you the opportunity to expand Medicaid really is going to make it that much more difficult for coverage for lots of people in Maine who need it.
All right. Well, Gordon, thank you so much for joining us today. Gordon Smith, the Executive Vice President of the Maine Medical Association. Julia, if no bill is passed, what happens then? The ACA stays in place, but I think everyone agrees that the ACA has problems that need to be fixed.
Yes, clearly the ACA has problems that need to be fixed. And actually, the Trump administration has made those problems worse by threatening not to pay the cost-sharing subsidies for lower-income people who were getting help, not just paying their premiums, but paying their deductibles and copayments. That's money that's supposed to be funneled back through to the insurers who offer those discounts. And there's been a lawsuit over it, and the administration every month has sort of dangled the possibility of not paying those because of the uncertainty. Insurers have been filing rates for next year that are in most cases at least 20% higher just based on that alone. So we're going to be seeing very large premium increases. We've seen companies dropping out of the market entirely. Again, they're mostly mentioning the uncertainty about what's going to happen. So there are already problems, and those problems have been exacerbated. Whether if this bill fails, Republicans and Democrats will get together. There are lots of ideas for how to stabilize the market. There's just no political agreement on what to do.
Okay, we're going to go to the call, so I'm going to start because we have so many coming in with Bill in Springvale. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I've been trying to get an answer to this since this health care fiasco blew up. How does the federal government plan on making this more affordable? The only thing that the health, including Obamacare mandate, are accessibility. Can you hear me?
Yeah. If you could turn off your television or radio, it'd be a lot easier.
Okay. Okay, is that better?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The only things that the health care plans mandate, including Obamacare, is accessibility. The federal government can't mandate costs. The insurance companies control the costs.
So, Bill, are you asking how the GOP bill would tackle this, or just in general?
Any plan in general. How do they plan on fixing this?
Okay, Julie, I'm going to let you tackle that.
You know, the Republicans and the Democrats pretty much agree on what the biggest problem is in the individual marketplace, people who buy their own insurance. And it's that deductibles are too high, out-of-pocket payments are too high, premiums to some extent are too high, although many people get help with their premiums. And interestingly, though they agree on that that's the problem, the Republican plan doesn't do a whole lot to fix that problem. It would make premiums more affordable for some people. As we talked about earlier, younger people would see their premiums go down a little bit while older people would see their premiums go up. So there could be some relief on the premium side, but there's not very much in this bill other than offering fewer benefits. So people could have less expensive premiums, but they wouldn't necessarily get all the same benefits. Now, if they don't need them, those people could save money. But for people who actually need their insurance, there's not a lot that makes this cheaper.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for your call. We're going to move on to Carol. Carol, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, thank you. Earlier this morning on Tom Ashbrook's program, I heard a backer of this new bill touting the switch from Medicaid from the federal program to private insurance, but it would be heavily subsidized with tax credits, he said. Now, Medicaid serves low-income people. And from personal and professional experience, I know that low and also sometimes middle-income people simply cannot afford they cannot afford to pay the premiums on a monthly basis and then wait for tax credits. So that piece of it to me seemed like a completely false promise. And I guess I would just ask for a comment and correct me if my analysis this is not correct.
And I'm going to toss that to you, Lori. Do your members understand that the switch will be to tax credits? And what are you hearing from them about that idea?
So I actually, hi, Carol, I actually listened to that show as well. It's kind of all healthcare all the time. And the per capita caps in Medicaid, the savings that Republicans are saying we'll see that would transfer over into the private market, we're not seeing. So we're talking about, as we think about Maine, the oldest state in the country, we're talking about capping a program and limiting growth that will cost the program billions of dollars over the next 20 years, where we know we have a large and growing long-term care population. To your point, it's not just low-income seniors, it's middle-income seniors who need access to long-term care services and often spend all of their assets because of the high cost of nursing home care. And then for older Americans in the individual market, what we're seeing is that the subsidies are not going to keep up with what will happen with 5-to-1 age rating. In fact, we've run some numbers. Of course, we're waiting on the CBO score, but our Public Policy Institute ran some numbers for 60-year-old Mainers in the individual market. And we're looking at premium increases from current law under the ACA anywhere from $5,400 more a year to $16,000 more a year. And we just see this as unsustainable for older Mainers.
Lori, thank you. And Carol, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Julie.
Can I add to that,
yes,
too?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's really important, for the first time, the Senate bill would allow people under 100% of poverty to get tax credits. Before, they couldn't because it was assumed that they would be on Medicaid because the Medicaid expansion was originally required before the Supreme Court said it was voluntary. The issue with this, though, is that, yes, these lower-income people would get help paying their premiums, but the help would be based on a less generous plan. Right now, the subsidies are calculated for a silver plan that pays about 70% of people's expected health care costs. They would now peg the subsidies to 58% of expected costs. So the subsidies would be less generous and would pay for less of a plan. And then they're getting rid of what we talked about earlier, these cost-sharing help where people could pay their deductibles and their copayments. So people might get some help with their premiums, but they still probably couldn't afford to use their care if they're under 100% of poverty.
Okay. And Julie, don't a lot of people who are under a certain level, under 100% of poverty, not pay income tax anyway? So a tax credit is sort of moot?
No, actually, these are what are called refundable advanceable tax credits, and they go to people regardless of how much they make, and they come monthly. They go actually directly to the insurance company. So you have to reconcile it when you file your taxes, but if you don't file taxes, then you don't have to reconcile it.
Okay, so we do need to take a quick break. We have lots of calls coming in. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine by the law firm of Eaton Peabody's Financial Institutions Group, working to provide effective counsel to meet the demands of banking clients in New England, and by the Tidewater Motel, offering waterfront lodging and meeting facilities on Final Haven Island. More at TidewaterMotel.com.
Rare earth metals. We need them for our gadgets and the Pentagon's weapons, but China has cornered the market.
So they now control from the basic raw materials all the way to the end products that go into, you know, all your fighters, all of our smart bombs, everything.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the Rare Earth Monopoly, next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. You've heard about it, so this is just a reminder. The Maine Public app is alive and well and being used by thousands. It allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Classical along with you anywhere and anytime for mobile or connected listenings or to catch up on the news. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones and tablets. It also gives you access to many PBS and Maine Public Television programs. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, and it's free.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the Senate proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare. With me in the studio, Lori Parham, State Director for AARP Maine. And on the line with us, Julie Rovner with Kaiser Health News. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling and post to our Facebook page. Lori Parham, tonight AARP is sponsoring an event with Senator King. Tell me about that.
Yes, we'll be hosting a teletown hall for our members, and Senator King will join us. And in essence, we have the ability to reach out to our thousands of members across the state. And what we plan to do is get an update similar to what we're doing right now. And it will be a chance for our members to ask the senator questions about the current proposal. One of our biggest concerns is that there's been so much information and noise that folks don't have the real facts about what's in the bill.
And how can someone attend that?
If they go to our Facebook page, AARP Maine, they can get a link and they can listen into the conversation.
Okay, great. Well, on the line with us now from Washington, D.C., Kirsten Sloan, Vice President for Policy with the American Cancer Society Action Network. Kirsten, thanks for joining us today. And what does the American Cancer Society think of the Senate bill?
Well, we've got some very serious concerns about what this means for people with cancer and survivors. For instance, if you take the example, let's say there's a 50-year-old woman with breast cancer. She could actually face premiums five times higher or more than she pays right now. And if she is able to get a plan, then she's not guaranteed any longer that that plan will cover the kind of innovative cancer treatment that she enjoys right now. And then depending on what state she lives in, the state could also allow insurers to once again set annual or lifetime limits on her coverage. So we're seeing a return back to a time when people with cancer or survivors had difficulty getting and keeping affordable quality health insurance.
What is the American Cancer Society's analysis, though, of the current plan of the ACA? How is that working?
Overall, it's working very well. We have millions of people who were uninsured before. It used to be that if you heard the words you had cancer, then trying to get or keep insurance was almost impossible. There were pre-existing condition exclusions. Insurers could rescind your policy or impose a lifetime or an annual limit on your coverage. All of that went away with the Affordable Care Act. Now, the ACA wasn't perfect. There are some improvements that certainly could be made, making premiums more affordable, making sure the market is stable. But what we're seeing in the Senate bill is actually a return to the wild, wild west of before.
All right. Well, Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us. Kirsten Sloan, Vice President for Policy with the American Cancer Society. Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network. We're going to go to Lynn, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. I'm 62 years old and have been very happily on Obamacare for the last couple of years. I have a question about the individual mandate. My understanding was that one of the Republicans' primary objections to the ACA was the individual mandate, the idea that a person had to have health care insurance whether they wanted to or not, and that a penalty was imposed if they did not. But my understanding was that the House bill, as it stood, raised premiums monthly for a whole year on anyone who let their insurance lapse. And my question is that also true of the Senate proposal? And if so, isn't that an even greater penalty than the Obama's CARES $600 if it's goes up every month for a whole year, and in effect that they're prolonging and actually reinforcing the individual mandate by raising those premiums if you let it lapse?
Julie Rovner.
The short answer is at the moment the Senate doesn't have anything to. I mean, all of these are ways of encouraging healthy people to sign up before they need care, because that's the only way the individual insurance market can function. Unlike the employer market, where people pay in not very much and most everybody does it and they get their insurance, in the individual market you're paying pretty much the whole freight. So basically, it favors people who really think they're going to need care. So that's why the individual mandate was there. It says that healthy people should buy insurance too. As you mentioned, the House said had a 30% surcharge for a year if you didn't maintain continuous coverage. The Senate at the moment doesn't have anything, although they've been talking about what's called a six-month lockout, where if you didn't have coverage or you missed a payment, you would have to wait 6 months before you could get coverage again. So there, everyone, you know, everybody argues, there's those who argue that that would make the risk pool worse because it would keep healthy people out, but sicker people in. There's a lot of arguments about how that would work, but we know that that's what the Senate is discussing, because without any compulsion for healthy people to, or even encouragement for healthy people to buy coverage, there's a concern that only sick people would buy coverage, and that just can't, the market can't work if that happens.
Lynn, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to go now to an email from TJ. There has been little said about the fact that as many as 50% of people in nursing homes are there because of Medicaid, called MaineCare in Maine. These are people, because Medicaid pays the cost, these are people who are poor to begin with, and or they've exhausted their life savings and assets and then end up with Medicaid paying their costs. Where would these people go? Who would care for them? It's not 1965 when Medicaid became law and when most families had a stay-at-home mom who looked after elderly parents. And many with conditions like post-stroke and Alzheimer's are serious disabled and could not be cared for at home without a live-in nurse.
Well, this question is the question, and TJ, it's something that really worries AARP. Currently, we know that unpaid caregivers, family caregivers, provide billions of unpaid care as it is, and if there isn't an option for people who really need round-the-clock care, what are we going to do? And, you know, it's really an unanswered question at this point. But with the Medicaid per capita caps, there are a lot of things that we could see. We could see, as Julie mentioned earlier, states could look at lowering reimbursements for providers. We've already seen in Maine nursing homes go out of business. Sometimes nursing homes are the only option in more rural parts of the state. We've heard stories of folks having to put a loved one in a nursing home very far away. And also, this impacts home and community-based care, because right now the entitlement is for nursing home care. And we know that it's much less expensive to serve people at home. And so we're talking about programs like respite and Homemaker Companion and other services. So this is why we're very concerned about what the current proposal would mean for seniors who need Medicaid.
All right, TJ, thank you for your question. We're going to go now to Taryn Bragdon. He is the CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability. He's a former Maine State legislator and former CEO of the Maine Heritage Policy Center. Taryn, thanks for calling in.
My pleasure. Thanks for letting me be a part.
What is your analysis of the Senate bill so far, what you know about it?
Well, I think certainly waiting for more information with the score from the Congressional Budget Office and their take on it, but we really see it as a big step in the right direction, both in reforming the Medicaid program so that it can be refocused on the truly needy, and then beginning to provide some flexibility and premium relief for people who have seen just massive premium increases under the ACA as a direct result of many of those negative requirements put on health insurance.
Let me ask you this. You said how this would refocus Medicaid on the truly needy. Explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, I think that the Medicaid program, when it started out, was really focused on both the poor elderly, poor kids, and those with disabilities. And one of the things that we are most concerned about with the expansion under the ACA was that Medicaid was changed, and all of a sudden funding, as well as people who were able-bodied adults, were prioritized ahead of those groups. There was more federal funding given to able-bodied adults, and the expansion really focused on them. And as states have struggled to afford their Medicaid programs, both before Medicaid expansion under the ACA, but also after, those individuals, whether it's the elderly or the disabled, have been kind of first in line for cuts. And so we really think that what the Senate draft does is it puts some reasonable limitations on per person's growth in Medicaid, but it also begins to equalize the funding between able-bodied adults and those with disabilities and the elderly. And we think that that makes sense, that the Medicaid program should really focus on the truly needy and shouldn't prioritize those individuals who are able-bodied and frankly, should be working in under employer-sponsored coverage, if at all possible.
Taryn, what would the Senate bill mean for the health insurance industry?
Well, I think that it would broadly be a much more competitive industry because some of the regulations that really restricted what kinds of plans could be offered are removed, allowing more different types of plans, more variation, so the individuals could choose from a really rich benefit package to more of catastrophic benefit package if that's what they were interested in. It maintains the tax credits for individuals who are getting insurance outside of their employer, so it still guarantees access. And in fact, for Maine, it expands access because those tax credits would be available for individuals who are in poverty, which they're not right now. But I think that it's a much different environment. Rather than health insurance carriers being much more focused on the federal government and funding they're getting from the federal government, it would set up a much more competitive health insurance environment, which really means better plans for individuals and that health insurance carriers have to be more responsive to patients, which I think is a good thing.
Lori, did you have a question for Taryn?
I was just going to mention that currently not only does Medicaid serve 1.4 million nursing home residents, but also 40 million children. So it covers a lot of people right now who would also be impacted by changes to the program. And so that is a real concern. As a state that didn't expand Medicaid, looking at our growing older population, there's a lot more we could be doing on the Medicaid side to be serving people at home and in the community, looking at programs that serve our large dual-eligible population. 31% here, we've got large numbers of folks who would be impacted by these changes. At the same time that the mix of the additional age rating to 5-to-1, reducing the number of people eligible for premium tax credits and reducing the amount of the tax credits available will mean more expensive coverage for a lot of people. So we just view it a bit differently.
Yeah, so Taryn, that's Lori Parham of AARP. As you well know, Maine's the oldest state in the nation and did not expand Medicaid. So is the analysis a little different for Maine than it is for the nation at large, for other states?
No, I think Maine has seen sort of what's possible when you return the Medicaid program to the truly needy. Because Maine did not expand and got its Medicaid house in order, investments were able to be made in expanding reimbursement for elderly in nursing homes, in home care, prioritizing those individuals who remained for years on waiting lists, individuals who have developmental disabilities, many of them near elderly themselves and living with their elderly parents. So I think this is where all of us would agree that there are certain vulnerable individuals who need to be taken care of in the Medicaid program. And one of the things that we've really seen is as that safety net has been stretched further and further, it's those most frail and most vulnerable individuals, poor elderly, those individuals with disabilities, who have really suffered and have been languishing on waiting lists. And we think that's wrong, and that those individuals need to be prioritized. And the Senate bill begins to provide fairness between the funding provided to those individuals who were the first population served by Medicaid and those that funding provided to able-bodied folks living in expansion states. And I think that's a good thing, both for Maine as well as the country.
Julie?
I'm just wondering what you tell someone who's been on Medicaid who's now going to get a tax credit to buy part of a plan that covers 58% of their expected health costs compared to Medicaid, where they don't have to pay. They have to pay very small cost sharing. How are they going to afford their deductibles and cost sharing?
Are you talking about somebody in Maine who would be in that situation?
I'm talking about somebody in any state who would be in that situation, who's going to lose Medicaid and instead get a tax credit.
Well, there's nobody in Maine who will be in that situation because the tax credits aren't available to folks who are eligible for Medicaid, and the tax credits are available to individuals in poverty who are not eligible for Medicaid, and they're not eligible for a tax credit right now. So if you have an adult with no kids and no disability who's in poverty right now in Maine, they don't have access to Medicaid or the tax credits, but under the Senate bill, they will. So I think they're getting something they don't have right now, rather than having something taken away, like you asked.
But how useful will it be if they basically get help to pay for part of a premium of a plan that they can't afford to use?
Well, I don't know. I think for paying 2% of their income for private health insurance that the average Mainer is paying hundreds of dollars a month for, I think will be beneficial to them. I think that some kind of catastrophic protection for individuals is significant, and providing something where they have nothing right now probably means something better. I think that the fact is we can be all things to all people and still afford it, and so we have to recognize that there are trade-offs.
All right. Well, Taryn Bragdon, thank you so much for calling in today. Taryn Bragdon, CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability and a former Maine State legislator. We do have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do BCM Environmental and Land Law, proud to announce the opening of their Portland office. Learn more at nhlandlaw.com, and by the Algonquin Playhouse production of Bullets Over Broadway, a musical comedy with Sally Struthers through July 29th, algonquinplayhouse.org.
The top employer in Steubenville, Ohio, isn't a steel mill or a coal mine or a factory. It's the local hospital.
If Trinity Hospital were to fail, this region economically would fail.
I'm Robert Siegel. How Ohio could lose jobs under the Republican efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear that broadcast this afternoon from 4 until 6:30. And stay tuned at 2 o'clock this afternoon for Ideas from the CBC, Pushing the Frontiers of Knowledge, the 2017 Killam Prize. Once a year, the Canada Council Killam Prize is bestowed on 5 of Canada's top academics in 5 different fields. And Ideas interviews this year's winner. That's Ideas from the CBC this afternoon at 2 p.m.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, repairing or repealing the Affordable Care Act, the GOP version of health care. Joining me today from Washington, Julie Rovner. She is the former health policy correspondent for NPR and is now with Kaiser Health News. In the studio with me, Lori Parham, State Director for AARP Maine. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to Marie, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Marie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a little bit overwhelmed. Sorry about that, because I've been hearing a lot of things that have raised some more questions for me. First, I want to say that providing access to plans just because insurance companies open them up does not help people if they don't have the expendable income to use that program. And what about if Maine has got it, quote-unquote, Medicaid health in order, according to the previous person that spoke. What about all the houses that take care of the mentally handicapped that have recently had to close? And there are a list of others that say that they're going to close. What's going to happen to those people? It's really scary. And providing catastrophic coverage is just slapping a Band-Aid on things. It's just not going to help people if you don't have access to reasonable health care options that allow you to, say, go to the dentist or have physical therapy to rehabilitate you to send you back to work. If I don't have health care coverage that provides adequate coverage to give me what I need, I may not be able to return to work, and then my coverage is going to change.
Lori, what you're hearing from Marie echoes what you're hearing from a lot of your members, isn't it?
Yes. And I think, you know, when we talk about these issues and we talk about folks who are able-bodied, who need to get back to work and find coverage, it often, you know, we forget about folks who do have a catastrophic illness, who do want to be working, who are looking to get back to work, but have needed help in the interim. And as Julie said earlier, the changes that we see in this proposal really do take us back to where we were at a time when folks really did struggle to get coverage. So I've got a gentleman who actually his costs through his employer were so expensive, he decided to get coverage through the individual market. He was able to make a change and really start to make a better income doing this. And then he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And so he's very concerned about what this is going to mean. He also needs hip surgery. And so this is someone who's working hard, who has a family. These are the stories we're hearing. And to the caller's concern, there's so much uncertainty in terms of what it's going to mean for people.
Julie Rovner, how important will the CBO report, whether it's released today or tomorrow, be to the fate of this proposal?
Well, while we've been sitting there here talking, the CBO actually announced that it will be coming out later today.
Okay,
and it will be very important. It's not entirely clear. They're also talking about, as we mentioned, adding a 6-month lockout basically for people who haven't maintained continuous coverage. It's not clear whether that will be part of the CBO score or not. That could make a big difference. But I think a lot of the senators who have expressed concerns, including Maine Susan Collins, say they want to see that CBO score and what CBO estimates will be the impact of this bill before they decide how they're going to vote.
Marie, thank you for your call. We're going to move to Art Blank, who is the president and CEO of the Mount Desert Island Hospital. Art, welcome to Maine Calling.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you believe the passage of the Senate bill would mean for your hospital?
I think for all hospitals in our state, we're very concerned that the restructuring of the Medicaid program wasn't actually part of the original ACA. So the Affordable Care Act actually gave states the chance to expand Medicaid. We didn't. What this bill does, though, is take a very significant amount of resources out of the program. So at the end of the day, this puts enormous pressures on state budgets, and we've already seen what kind of impact state budget pressure has had on our Medicaid program just in the last few years. So we're very concerned about the impact it's going to have on our state budget along with others around the country. The other concern that we have is that the subsidies that are provided through the Affordable Care Act's individual marketplace are going to be significantly more limited in this bill. And, the Affordable Care Act actually revived an individual market that had pretty much dwindled off. We had one carrier offering comprehensive care throughout our state, and the typical deductible on those plans pre-ACA were $10,000 to $15,000. With the advent of the Affordable Care Act, we now have over 70,000 people who are receiving individual coverage, and 85% of those are subsidized. These subsidies that are in the Senate bill are significantly reduced. It's better than what was in the House bill, but they are significantly reduced, and we're concerned that it actually will undermine the long-term viability of the individual market altogether, not to mention the fact that all of the folks that are currently getting insurance, and particularly the older and sicker patients that we care for, will now be cared for
I know many of the small hospitals in Maine have a majority of Medicaid and Medicare patients. Yeah. Would the small hospitals, including yours in Maine, survive this plan?
I'm sure that some wouldn't. I'm very positive of that. The many rural hospitals in Maine are really living check to check at this point because we've already sustained significant changes in our ability to get paid for the services that we provide. And this is really going after some of the underpinnings of those payment systems.
Art Blank, thank you so much for joining us. He's the president and CEO of the Mount Desert Island Hospital. Julie, are you hearing similar concerns from hospitals around the country?
Yes, hospitals are absolutely. I'm freaking out is the only phrase I can think of. They're very concerned, particularly hospitals that were already having trouble. The Medicaid expansion in most states has helped them tremendously. And even the states that did not take the expansion, like Maine, the restrictions on funding that are anticipated by this legislation would be really devastating for hospitals that really depend on a lot of this money to keep their doors open.
Michelle on Facebook asks, please tell older Mainers how to figure what their rates would be under the GOP plan. Lori, is that something you can do at this point?
We did do some initial analyses for individuals, and I'm happy to run through a few of them, depending on income. For someone who is 60 years of age and making $40,000, you would see premiums in 2020 increase from current law by $5,400. And we can post this information for folks. If you are making $45,000 a year, again, you would see an increase in premiums in 2020 by $16,729. These are numbers that reflect a 5-to-1 age rating. And also look at data from our Public Policy Institute. For those with lower incomes, you will also see an increase in out-of-pocket costs. And we're estimating for someone, again, 60 years old, making $20,000 a year, you'll see an out-of-pocket increase of about $8,600. A little less if you're making $30,000, about $5,500. So everything that we're, all of the numbers we're running show for people over 50 in that 50 to 64 year old age bracket that they're going to see increases in cost.
Julie, Sonia on Facebook asks, who is helped by the proposed healthcare changes?
Well, certainly, some people who do not get tax credits now would be able to get tax credits. Younger people, because of this change in the age ratings, where older people would have to pay more, younger people would pay less. Right now, they're helping subsidize the older people. And all the people who benefit from the tax cuts. Remember, this was the Affordable Care Act had an enormous amount of tax increases, mostly for the wealthy, and also for the healthcare industry to pay for the benefits. As Congress is anticipating rolling back the benefits, they're giving those taxes back to the people that they were taxing. So that's the healthcare industry largely and the sort of top 1% of taxpayers. So those people would all be helped.
All right. We'll go quickly to Lucille in Bangor. Hi, Lucille. We're almost out of time. So if you could make your question quick, that'd be great.
None of the media or the newspapers have said anything about what this would do to the Medicaid buy-in, Quimby, Slimby, or QI. Could you answer that? Thank you.
Julie, do you know what she's talking about?
I do know what she's talking about, and she's right. I don't think I've seen anything. I don't anticipate that this would change that. Right now, those are programs where people who are just slightly above Medicaid eligibility level can pay, basically, to have Medicaid coverage. I don't think that would change, but the difference would be if the states have less money to pay for Medicaid, whether that would be something that, that they might choose not to participate in.
All right, Lucille, good question. Thank you. And I think we have time to squeeze in one more question. So, J.D., if you could ask your question quickly, that would be great.
Yeah, I have a question. My employer actually covers part of my health care. Currently, my premium's gone from where we pay $15 a month to $74 a week is what we pay. And I don't see either of you addressing what this does for people in my classification. I make around $650 a week. And I can't afford to use my health care because the premium deductibles are so high that I can't afford to get sick.
Julie?
Well, this is exactly what I was talking about at the beginning, that one of the big problems with the Affordable Care Act that it didn't address is that it helped people pay their premiums, but it didn't help people access their policies, basically, the people with $6,000, $7,000, and $10,000 deductibles who just can't afford to use their insurance, even if they have it. This obviously we're talking about employer provided insurance, but we're seeing higher deductibles in employer provided insurance, too, which is, you know, basically we're having an argument about who should pay for coverage. And we're not talking about how much we should be paying for health care. And it's because the cost of health care is rising so rapidly that nobody can keep up with how to pay for it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, J.D., and you will be our last question today. And thank you so much, Julie Rovner, the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow and Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, also with us, Lori Parham, the Maine State Director for AARP. George Thomas ran the board today. Sam Dearen answered your calls. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about fire safety. We'll have the Maine fire marshal and a forest ranger specialist. We'll talk about the update on the fire at the Sanford Mill and also look at handling fireworks and the best smoke detectors for your home. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.